Blog Talk Radio.
Lots of events are being canceled. Motley Crue, Def Leppard, Joan Jett, and Poison canceled their tour. People who own sleeveless jean jackets are devastated. And Gay Pride is canceled. Taking its place is straight shame. I'm Brett Singer. This is the show. That's right, people. Straight shame. Straight shame is good. We should be ashamed. Brett from the bunker, we are here. We are live. It is Thursday, May 21st. It is the year 2020. We like to remind you of the year. Someone's playing music outside. That's very startling. Stop that. Don't you know I'm doing a show? I am joined today by Adam Gable. Adam, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Brett. How are you today?
I am okay. I'm okay. Now, I ask everyone this. How are you holding up?
I don't think we have enough time in this entire podcast for me to answer that question.
What's the thumbnail version? Is there a short version of how you're holding up?
Somewhere between pretty good and really, really, really awful is what I would say.
I think that's universal, relatable content right there, because that is definitely, you know, I feel like it goes day to day and even moment to moment is kind of how.
Yeah.
I
by
feel.
The way, I wanted to point out that Straight Shame, I saw them at the Beacon in 1997. That was a fantastic show, I'll tell you that.
Were they good? Did they play all the hits?
They were good, but they weren't too proud of themselves is what I would say. They
right.
played, they apologized, you know.
I like it. Now, you do a lot of one-liners in your act. Is that a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment, which is just another way of saying that I edit my jokes.
Oh, so you wouldn't necessarily call them one-liners. You would just say well edited.
No. I would call them one-liners. I just
okay.
I find that it was just sort of more of a comment about other comics who could be doing one-liners if they just put just the funny part in their joke.
Ooh, throwing a little shade there. That's not bad. I like that.
Yeah, I already hate myself for saying that. I'll tell you.
It's live. That's actually an interesting point because certainly there are times when, you know, when we go on, when, you know, and you sort of cut it back to Joe DeVito likes to say the funny part last and stop talking, you know, so and he's also a big edit the joke guy. So
work
hard on editing your jokes, I guess.
Well, a lot of what it is that I find that my first, like the first idea can be encapsulated very quickly and snappily in a very quick joke. And then the rest of the bit winds up not even making it to the stage because the four other points that I'm trying to make don't quite work. Now, I will say that when I started, my first instinct was first joke, move on to the next subject. And I didn't really explore a lot of topics in depth. I've started doing that more recently, but I guess I find it harder to get to the funny part quicker the further you get into the center of the onion, if you will.
So the more you go down that rabbit hole or down the yellow brick road or whatever metaphor you want to use, the harder it
yeah.
is to find the really funny part. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I find myself meandering a little bit once I get past the initial point. So I wrote some jokes this week, and I was working on them. And, you know, I was reading them for some other comics, and, like, the first line in the bit, huge laugh, and then the second line, all right, and then the fourth line, all right. At that point, that's just going to become a one-liner joke.
Interesting. Do you like those? I mean, or is it just kind of what you write? Or, I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, like, is that your goal? Do you sit down and say, I'm going to write a short joke?
Well, I think that's kind of what I was getting at, is that initially my goal was just to write one-liner jokes and then move on to the next subject. That was what I was trying to do. I have found lately, you know, as you start to do longer shows and you realize that 45 minutes is 180 one-liner jokes. That's a lot of time to film.
It sure is.
It's a lot of different ideas. So, because it's usually about, like, a one-liner joke is you can squeeze four or five of those into a minute. So if you do an hour-long set, it's a lot of ideas. So sometimes it's – and every time you change your idea, the audience kind of goes, oh, what's going on here? Like, you have to, they sort of have to reacclimate themselves. You're on a highway, there's six lanes. Then you get onto a two-lane highway. Then you get onto a one-lane highway. Then you get onto a four-lane highway. Every time you switch highways, you have to reacclimate the way you're driving. So every time you change the subject, the audience has to, like, get taken out of what they're doing and move on to the next subject, which can be jarring repeatedly and constantly over the course of a very long set. So I find that sometimes it's helpful in a longer set to develop ideas a little bit further, a little bit, flesh them out a little bit more. But I honestly find them very hard. I find it hard to figure out where the joke is going after that first line.
Do you does it help you at all to group your one-liners together by subject?
Yeah, but that's more of a memory kind of thing, because to me, like, I have a lot of jokes about drugs, right? And they're not really all really related, except for the fact that they're all drug jokes. They are still, if you will, different streets in the neighborhood. It's still a left turn every time I talk about something new. That's really just helpful for me to remember to say everything that I want to say. If, all right, I got 16 drug jokes, I'm going to do all those, and then I'm going to move on to the next thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it harder to remember the one-liners? Like, because I found that it is. Like, when I started, I was very, you know, sort of disconnected one-liners, and I found it more difficult to memorize that set. And now, to be fair, I was also just starting, so maybe that was part of it too. But as I got more into it and I was sort of doing, you know, things that were more topic-oriented, I found it a little easier to commit it to memory.
I found that if I like the joke, I don't have a problem remembering it.
Oh, interesting.
It's really a matter of I tend to forget the things that I'm not as comfortable with, whether that's because I'm doing a set that I've done many times, and I know that, you know, and I know that even in the best of audiences, this joke doesn't always land. I'm gonna forget that joke if I'm in an audience that's not really with me, if I'm not in my ideal comfort zone. And then also it means new jokes that I'm not 100% comfortable with yet tend to fall out of my head. But I don't have a problem if I was just going to do, like, if I was on a one-liner show and they wanted me to do 15 minutes of just one-liner, new idea every laugh, and I knew exactly what I was going to do for those 15 minutes, I probably wouldn't have a problem getting through all of them without forgetting anything.
Interesting. So do you find that the comics you like also are one-liner-oriented comics?
Yeah, I mean, one-liner comedy has sort of evolved a little bit because, you know, people think about guys like Mitch Hedberg as, you know, the sort of ideal one-liner comic of the last 20 years. But if you listen to his material, he's got a lot of, you know, it's similar to the kind of pattern that I was talking about, where there's, you know, it's a one-liner joke and then, you know, a minute or two of riffing about that one-liner and then on to the next one. That's the kind of stuff that, yeah, that appeals to me the most. I have a lot of difficulty with conversational comedy. I find it to be very boring. And, I mean, not that I necessarily don't like it. It just doesn't hold my interest. You know, I'm not a very, I don't like to throw a lot of shade at other comics, despite what happened in the first minute of this podcast. It's not really my thing. The conversational stuff is harder for me to pay attention to. I think it's more because my mind starts to wander about how whatever the person is talking about starts to affect me and where I would go with that subject. If somebody's talking about something that is beyond my scope of, I wouldn't say understanding, but beyond my way of thinking, then I'm more likely to stick with them to see where they take it.
Interesting. Because I would say certainly a lot of comedy has become very conversational as people are kind of doing, you know, longer, chattier bits I tend to gravitate more towards the really structured jokes.
Right.
But I also feel like that structure is there in any good joke. Like, if it's a well-written joke, it's a well-written joke. Like, it doesn't, you know, whether or not it's a one-liner or whether it's one bit that goes on for, you know, 7 or 8 minutes, you know, if someone put in the time on it, then you're going to notice, you know, you're going to be able to tell.
I think Jim Gaffigan is probably the best example of that because, yeah, I'm Gaffigan is really one of my favorites. I mean, I would probably say Hedberg and Gaffigan are probably my two people whose specials I can watch over and over and over again. And I think that, to me, Gaffigan is not a one-liner comic, but the structure of his jokes is very, it's like you said, very, very set-up premise punch, set-up premise punch, or premise set-up punch. I guess I said it backwards. So I don't necessarily think that I'm a fan of the one-linery stuff as much as I am the structure, and again, the more sort of absurdist, esoteric kind of topics. You know, to me, it's, you think about the Hot Pocket or the sea cow joke. I mean, nobody else is going to say that. Right. I mean, you listen to Gaffigan talk about sea cows and manatees and how other people in the ocean, other fish are calling them a sea cow. To me, it's just my mind would never go there.
So right.
When he's talking, I'm listening. I'm just listening.
Right. You're taking that journey with him because a lot of that is because he's put in the work. I mean, one of the fun things about being in New York is you get to see, you know, you can get to see some of these guys like working on their material. I've seen him at Gotham a number of times.
Yeah.
And I saw him 1 week and then I saw him again a couple of weeks later. And because he drops in on the new talent shows. And so I was going to a bunch of those.
Right, right, right.
And he had tweaked the joke. Like it was a little tweak. I wish I could remember exactly which joke, but it was like he'd moved a word. He'd written a new tag. I find that fascinating to listen to.
What blows me away about seeing the pros, you know, and I'm, when I say the pros, I mean the, like, you know, the celebrity comedians, right? Like not the people that you and I know that no one's ever heard of, but when I'm on a show, or I'm watching a show and a celebrity, a Seinfeld, a Gaffigan, or, you know, Judah Friedlander drops in or whatever, and they're doing their, it's amazing to watch them and see that sort of uncomfortability with the new material never really disappears, because I've seen that same thing that you've seen. And you know, so the Gaffers will come out and every, you know, it's always a huge, huge response. And then the first minute or two is just sort of the audience being like, I can't believe I'm watching Jim Gaffigan, and they laugh at everything. And then they're like, all right, let me work on some new jokes. And they pull out a piece of paper, or they, you know, they take out their phone or whatever. And you can see on their face that it switches. And suddenly they're the 2-year comic again, going, God,
right,
these people like this thing that I'm saying. And to a certain extent, there, with them, it's even, the stakes are even higher, because you don't want to be the celebrity that 200 people saw in a club and bombed. I mean, there's that scene in, do you ever see that movie Comedian, the Seinfeld Comedian movie?
Yes.
Right. So there's the moment where, he did, I'm Telling You for the Last Time, which is that special where he did all the jokes from the late 80s to the mid 90s that everybody knew. He closed that off, and then he went and started workshopping brand new material. And you got to hand it to that guy for doing that, for being at the top of the world.
He could have been just fine doing the old stuff, and he did not need to throw it out, but he did.
He did. He could have been saying, take my wife, please, for 60 years, and people would have been applauding. But so you got to hand it to him. There's that scene where he's on stage at Stand Up New York, and he's sort of like meandering through these ideas that are completely undeveloped. And you hear the woman in the audience go, is this your first time? And the audience just loves it. And if you look, if you freeze that movie on that moment, you can see it on his face. I mean, that's the face of an open micer who's never been on stage before.
Right.
It's amazing. That sort of goes back to what I was saying about how hard it is to sort of get down to really the meat of the joke, even though the biggest celebrities have difficulty finding the funny in the joke.
Well, it takes time. I mean, that's, you know, he's another one that I've seen, you know, show up at Gotham on new talent shows. I got bumped for him once, which was actually worked out quite well for me. I wound up with an extra spot. But he comes in and he did a joke that I had seen him do a year before and had a new tag, you know, which means he's not giving up on something. He's not throwing it out. He's still working it. And again, like he doesn't need to. Like, he doesn't really need to do anything because he's making $50 million a year just sitting at home. But regardless of that, like, clearly this is what he really loves to do, and he's just going to keep doing it. He wants to be out there trying out new stuff, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I think a year ago most of us would have said, well, yeah, why would you do anything other than just sit at home and collect money? But I mean, that's what I'm doing right now, and I'm pulling my hair out. So I can sort of understand where, you know, his desire. I understand that, and I hope that that's, you know, hope to always continue to grow in that way. I mean, that's really what makes somebody unforgettable.
Are you doing Zoom shows?
Yeah, I've done a couple of Zoom shows. I started out doing sort of just sitting at my desk and reading jokes, you know, just reading jokes into the my computer. But I realized that I really enjoy part of what I enjoy about performing is being on stage and, you know, really kind of getting into it and relating to people. So I rearranged my house a little bit. So I've got my computer on a shelf. And I have like a stage. The way if you watch me on a Zoom show, you can actually see pretty much from my knees to the top of my head with a couple inches above. Because I want the audience to sort of get the experience of watching a comedian on stage. Otherwise, it's just like, you know, it's a workshop. We're all sitting around a table. And
right.
I don't think that's part of the stand-up comedy experience. I mean, I think it is part of the stand-up comedy experience to watch the performer in a different environment. Is set up like a show, etc.
Interesting. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's tricky. I mean, I don't have a place in my apartment that I can set up in that way. Like, I sort of wish I could hang a curtain or do something to make it a little more stagey. I have moved into my office and it's great in a lot of ways, but what's not so great is the background, and my computer doesn't want to do virtual backgrounds for some reason. So,
right.
You know, you're stuck looking at my shelves, and that's not fun. I do like to hold a microphone. That has sort of been my concession to it. Like, I feel like that's a little tiny thing that I can do that helps me feel a little more like I'm doing a show, and maybe helps the audience feel a little more like they're watching a show.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, anything that you can do to communicate to the audience that you are the comic. I mean, especially on these Zoom shows, because, you know, we're all in the same box, right? I mean, everybody in Zoom is equal. It's not like on a show where you're raised above them a couple inches on the stage.
Oh,
you're standing,
interesting.
And you're holding a microphone. Everybody in Zoom is equal. It's just a matter of, especially if there's nobody spotlighting stuff, anybody at any point in a Zoom show can just start talking. And if there's nobody managing it, then suddenly they're the comic on stage. So yeah, microphone's great. I honestly would like to go out and get one of those. I just haven't done it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's why I had one. So it was, you know, not a big deal. I bought a cable that I can actually hook it up to the computer. So that way, because right now it's just a prop. I actually have no idea what I did with the cable. I bought it and it just got eaten by my apartment. So it's here somewhere. So eventually I'll plug that in and then you get a little more of a pop with the audio, but you know, whatever. Like, again, it's sort of, can I do this one little thing to maybe make it a little more, I didn't thought about it that way, but like you said, it's separation. It's sort of something to kind of elevate you in a little bit, you know, away from that you're just another person on the Zoom call. You're just, you know, you're the guy telling jokes. Listen to me. Give me attention.
I mean, a show. I always talk about this in theater, which is my background's in theater. Before I was a comedian, I was a lighting designer for theater and television.
Oh.
They always talk about the contract with the audience, right? Like, you're in a Broadway show. There's 800 people in a room and 6 people on stage. And the 6 people on stage are having a conversation about something that everybody in that theater knows is not true, right? They're talking about what's going to happen when some child who never existed is going to grow up. It's a contract with the audience. The audience paid to be entertained. And their part of it is to sit and listen. And our part of it as a performer is to give them something that is worth value. And if you don't, if as the performer, you don't give them something that appears to have any value, then they won't listen.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, you were a lighting designer in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in Brooklyn my whole life. So I grew up in – I went to high school in Brooklyn, and I got into theater backstage. I got into theater backstage in high school because they didn't have anywhere to put me on stage, and I just kind of wanted to be a part of it. And then that sort of led to a career as I went to college for lighting design, and then I worked for about probably 15 years strictly as a lighting designer, production manager. Sort of, I travel all over the world, really over the Western Hemisphere, and I worked with a lot of different people. All of that has sort of really informed my understanding of the way the comedy business exists, and I found that to be pretty helpful.
Wait, what informed your, just the travel, you mean, or the theater experience?
The understanding of entertainment as a whole. Comics, by nature, we're very self-involved. It's all about us, right? I mean, like, we're on stage, nobody else is performing. There's really not much else to a comedy show. I mean, you have audio, but you don't really need audio work. It's just you need a microphone. And you need lights, but you don't need, like, a lighting creator. You just need – it's really the only thing that's happening on stage is a person talking. And I find that some comics who have come up just through stand-up comedy don't understand the entirety of what's happening. And I think it makes it harder for them when they're not on stage to function in the world of stand-up comedy. They don't know how to relate to people. They don't understand really, like, it's funny, you're on a comedy show with four other comics, eight other comics, 10 other comics. Every single comic is having the exact same experience that you are, right? Whether they've until they get on stage, they're having the exact same. But every stand-up comedian thinks that that show is just about them. Everybody that goes on after them, everybody who goes on before them is an opener, and everybody who goes on after them, the audience forgot, right? But you got eight comics on a show. That can't be true about everybody. Every comic can't be the audience's favorite. If you think about it like that, from an outsider's perspective, you start to realize that even the most solitary art form, stand-up comedy or you know, singer-songwriter music, which would be the next correlation, even that is a team effort. And I think that kind of thing really helps to grow people, to grow in the entertainment business.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a really good point. I have a theater background, so I it's one of the things that I've always appreciated about comedy is how much easier it is than theater. Like, it's just so much easier to put on a comedy show than it is to put on a theater show. Like, I don't pay for the venue. Like, I get to produce a show at a venue, and I come in and, you know, we do a box office split, and it's like, okay, that's easy. They keep the drinks, you keep the tickets, you know, something along those lines. And it's just, you know, the idea, like, you couldn't do that with theater. It just wouldn't work. And, you know, like with lighting, like you get whatever lights are there and you just sort of deal with it. Like, it's not, you're not going to bring in a designer. That's crazy. And I know there are a lot of comedians that sort of know something about sound and maybe know, you know, how to plug into the soundboard and things of that nature, but you don't have to. Like, that's not a requirement.
Right.
All you got to do is just get up there and use the damn microphone.
Yeah. But again, it's, I think a theater background helps to most comics. It's funny because comedians are like the only people I've met in the entertainment world who don't understand the rest of what's happening in entertainment. I mean, I talked to somebody who works, let's say they own a chain of dry cleaners, right? Let's say I'm talking to George Jefferson, right? And I tell him that I used to do lighting and a lighting designer, and that kind of person wouldn't understand what that means. I mean, most lay people think that the lighting for a theater show is just you turn the lights on and it's all there.
Right.
Now, you and I know that that's not the case.
Right.
Everybody else in the entertainment business has an understanding of the levels of that you go down to when you're building a set and audio and lighting and projection. I feel like comedians in general don't really understand that. And it's part of, again, the nature of the business that we're in is you don't really involve yourself with it.
That's interesting. I mean, I feel like some do. I feel like at some point, maybe the longer you're in comedy, I don't know, I'm just sort of going through in my head, I'm thinking about the people who I feel like do talk about the lighting and do talk about the sound and sort of, you know, some of the other aspects. Like maybe when when you've got a lot more years in, but, you know, but you don't really have to. Like you can get by just getting up there and just telling your jokes, like, without really thinking that much about all the other aspects.
I mean, I would guess, though, that if you talk to a comedian who's been doing comedy for 2 years and has had to produce their own shows, they will have a better understanding of some of lighting and sound than a guy like Bert Kreischer, who really was famous. He was a hit from the moment he walked on stage. I don't know.
Oh,
you know,
right?
He was dared. He was that movie Van Wilder with what's his face? Ryan Reynolds is based on Bert Kreischer, right? Right. So after that, after he had sort of gained some notoriety as the, you know, the number one frat boy in the country, somebody who was trying to cut him down, trying to take away his celebrity, suggested he was talking to somebody. It was a comedian, and it was like, oh, I bet I could do stand-up comedy, in the, and I bet I could do a 45-minute set, no problem. And whoever the comedian was like, sure, go ahead, do that. I think you could, expecting that he would go on stage and after 2 minutes bomb for, you know, realize how hard it is. He according to his version of the story, is that he was a hit at the first show and the second show. He didn't start to bomb until he was five shows in or something. He never had a bomb until he was five shows in. But even by then, he was already sort of well-known as a comedian. So I bet that if you talked to him, it would have taken him a long time before he really start getting involved in the technical aspects of things. Because why would you? I mean, if you're funny and you want to be funny and you can sell out an arena or a theater and have 500, 1,500 people laughing at your jokes, why would you bother learning anything about lighting? Other than stand here, right? I mean, I wouldn't know.
Right. No, that's fair. That makes sense. Yeah, because I certainly learned a ton just doing producing shows, which I started doing pretty early. That was really a key part of just getting stage time. You know, like one great way to get stage time was make your own damn show, and then you can get it. You know, get it on. But that's interesting about Bert Kreischer. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm not 100% of the specific details of the story, but the point is that he was very lucky. I mean, he's got the version of the comedy, the rise to stardom that most comedy people who don't know a lot about comedy think is what it is. I mean, that's the problem with comedy. Is that everybody thinks, well, you're funny, so you go on stage and you're funny. And if you're on stage and you're not being funny, it's because you're not funny, so you should quit being a comedian. Which to me is one of the hardest things that about being a comedian, and honestly, one of the things that I found very similar about lighting design, that people don't know anything about lighting. They just know when it's bad. They know when the lighting is bad. They don't know when the lighting is good. And they know when comedy is bad, but they really don't know when comedy is good.
I think they know. You don't think they know when it's good? I feel like they got, you know, I mean, ultimately, if the comedy's good, you're laughing, right? I mean, or if the comedy could be bad and you could still be laughing. That's
kind of
unfortunately
true.
Yeah, I guess you can still laugh at pretty awful comedy. Because obviously there are famous comedians where you're like, really? I don't get it. Like, that's not making me laugh, but it's making a lot of other people laugh. So I guess it works.
Right.
Does that drive you nuts to hear a story like Bert Kreischer's, where he just sort of gets up and just crushes from the minute he gets there?
It does really drive me nuts, especially because I have a lot of difficulty connecting with the audience. I think that people who read my jokes might even appreciate them more than if I was telling them on stage, because I'm not necessarily easy to watch or listen to. But as far as Bert Kreischer goes, I think he's the exception that proves the rule. So it doesn't bother me as much, because I haven't heard a lot of those stories about people. I mean, we have all heard the stories about the guy who goes on, or the comic who goes on stage in front of 15 of their friends and crushes the first time and then goes to an open mic the next week and bombs. That's
right.
That's 90% of the stories. So to me, I think that's the Bert Kreischer thing. It bugs me on the level of him, but not to the extent that really it happens very often.
Now, what do you mean when you say you're not easy to listen to and not easy to watch on stage?
I think that people one of the hardest things that I have is a lot of my jokes, like you said, they're one-linery jokes, and the conversational aspect of comedy is more prevalent. So a lot of audience members, they hear jokey jokes where it's like ba-ba-da-ba-da, da-da-da-da-da, and they think, oh, that person stinks. That's not a funny joke. They associate – a lot of audience members associate jokey jokes with bad jokes or corny jokes or bad jokes. So a lot audience members have – I find that the audience has difficulty getting used to the type of material that I'm doing, and also the way that I'm delivering it. I like to embrace the weirdness. I like to embrace my weirdness. I find that the jokes that I do are more from are a little bit out of the reach of the audience. So I like to let the audience know that I'm a little strange and the jokes are a little strange, but I don't think that people really I don't think everybody can quite understand that. Sometimes they think, well, I understand what he's saying, but I have no idea why he's saying any of this.
Now, has comedy gotten a little too normal? Like, because wasn't it supposed to be a place for weirdos? Aren't comedians supposed to be weird?
I do think that comedy has gotten a little too normal. I would rather have a comedian. It's like what I was saying before about the types of things that I prefer to hear a comedian talk about, things that I never would have thought about. I mean, you know, everybody, you can break comedy down in, you can bifurcate comedy a million different ways. But one of the ways that I've noticed is that a lot of comedians go, this is something that you and I think. Isn't that funny? I prefer to say, this is what I think. Isn't that funny? And a lot of, I think audience members don't understand why I'm talking about something that I know that they don't agree with.
Interesting. So I mean, you're going out of their comfort zone a bit, and maybe that doesn't really, they're not sure what to do with that. You're not talking about, you know, hamburgers, or I'm trying to think of some, I don't even know what tack anymore. I mean, Tiger King was the one for a long time. That was the open mic.
Tinder and dating and sex.
Tinder and dating. Like, it used to be Facebook, but I guess that's at this point we're all on Facebook. We just have to accept that. But yes, Tinder and dating. I always try to look for. Sorry, go ahead.
I do agree with your idea that comedy used to be a place to meet the weirdo, to meet the person who was not like your neighbor, and I think that is gone. I never thought about it like that, but yeah, I definitely think that comedy is moving more towards normalcy, and I would like to see it move more towards abnormalcy.
Well, like, what else was Mitch Hedberg gonna do? You know, sell insurance.
Right.
I mean, you know, Mitch Hedberg was clearly needed to be on stage telling those jokes. If he ain't doing that, he's the funniest guy working at Dunkin' Donuts. You know, like, it's just he's got to be on stage. He's got to be telling those jokes. It just sort of emerges out of him, like, whether he wants it to or not.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
I mean, I think it'd be, you know, it sort of always has to be a place for that. But I don't know, because I'm relatively new to it. I'm only like a year and a half in. So way I pay attention to comedy significantly changed when I started doing comedy. So I don't know when this change might have happened or what, you know, but that was something that somebody, another comic brought up to me. And I always thought that was interesting. This idea that it's sort of, you know, comedy being less a place for sort of the misanthropes, the, you know, the weirdos, the damaged people, things of that nature.
I don't know. I mean, I think that there was a point where it might have been when the celebrity of comedy really kicked in, because, you know, there was a time in the early nightclubs, you know, after the days of the Catskills, when that kind of thing was moving more into nightclubs. And if you had material, then you could just go on stage. I mean, you didn't have to audition. You didn't have to get passed. You didn't have to do bringers. You didn't have to do open mics. If you wanted to be a comedian, you go on stage, because at that point, the idea of being a comedian was atypical. People wanted to live their regular life. They wanted to go to work. They wanted to come home, have dinner, watch TV, and go to sleep. People didn't want to live that nightclub kind of life. And at some point, the idea of that life became attractive, and more people started to flock to it. And I guess that's probably when more normal people started, when the regular guy just wanted to be on stage. And maybe that's when it went away, I guess.
Do you like that life? I mean, obviously we can't have it now, so we would like any life. But is that when things are normal, like, do you enjoy that, the kind of going out at night and being in the clubs?
Oh, yeah. I've never been a fan of 9-to-5 kind of life, coming home, sitting, and doing the same thing every night. I want to be out. I want to travel. Even as a comedian, I've traveled all over the country. I've seen all kinds of different people, all kinds of different places, performed all kinds of different ways. To me, that's what I want my life to be about. I don't want to live the same day in and day out.
No, doing something different every day is I find very appealing. That's always I've always, most of my life I've always had my own career. Where I had my own business, and things were different. Like as soon as things got to be too much the same, I got bored. Like I wanted to do something else. So yeah, no, I totally agree with that. No, it's also been fun. I mean, the camaraderie of it. I mean, it's been terrific in the pandemic. I mean, these Zoom open mics that we do. I mean, that's definitely been a big part of kind of my mental health and kind of keeping connected to people. Like I know I'd be watching more Netflix if I wasn't doing comedy, but I don't think that would be a good thing. Like I'm much happier kind of spending a lot of my day writing jokes and then, hitting at least one open mic a day and just kind of getting those jokes out. And even if it's got a limited shelf life, whatever, we're going to be here for a while. And maybe tomorrow I'll work on something that's got a little bit of a longer life. Are you writing a lot of COVID stuff, a lot of quarantine stuff?
I am, but not exclusively that. I've been writing, it's what I'm thinking about. So a lot of it is about COVID, but about how it relates to the rest of my life.
Right.
I mean, an example of a joke that I wrote, I don't know, 6 weeks ago. We were 2 weeks into this thing, was about how if it wasn't for all these Zoom shows, I'd forget what it's like not to be booked on anything, right? Like, and that to me that's a joke about a quarantine, but it's really not. It's a joke about not getting booked as a comedian. So I mean, that's always going to be what my approach is going to be, is how can I make a statement that is sort of not about. Start with a statement that everybody understands to make a statement that nobody understands. That's a lot of what my comedy is anyway. So a lot of my jokes I'm getting into through a COVID door, but then you walk in and it's a completely different joke.
Is that how you write? Like you sort of start with one kind of statement and then sort of pull the rug out?
Yeah, actually that's really one of the best ways to describe it. I mean, I'll sort of say something in my head, and then I'll try and come up with the least expected follow up to the statement in a way that people can understand. That to me, I mean, a joke is a happy surprise, a joyful surprise. So I like to make the connection. In my mind, the joy is made when you connect the first part of the statement to the second start of the second part of the statement. That's where the joy, the aha moment to me comes from, the connection. But a lot of people just, a lot of the joy is just in punching down, I guess. So that's not necessarily about the left turn as much as it is about laughing at the other person. To me, I like to not punch down. I like to try and take the left turn. So yeah, a lot of the times it's actually the way you described it. Say one thing and see what the least likely thing that could follow is.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good method. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I can see that in your jokes. I mean, that's the other thing that's been fun about the Zoom mics is sort of meeting people that I hadn't met before, and and hearing their jokes. I like hearing everybody's take. Like I actually really enjoyed that, and it's the kind of thing where since we don't have clubs to go to, and you can go to the Zoom shows, but. It just, I don't know. I find the open mic thing, you get sort of see more people in a shorter amount of time. And I think it's interesting that we're all experiencing the same thing. And then, so what's everybody's take on it? Like I got tired of the Tiger King stuff because I'm not into it. I didn't watch it. I don't really want to watch it. I didn't really care. But it's not like, obviously, quarantine, we're all living it. And well, what does Adam have to say about that? Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to just write as much as I can. I mean, in some ways, we're all in a really good position. I would say probably you more so necessarily. I mean, I'm assuming that a year and a half in, you didn't have too many things. You were working towards a lot of things, but there's not a lot of foothold for you to lose, if you will. Like, this is a good time to write and to become a better comedian and to have more material. Those are the people. The further your people are in comedy, the more they have, the more connections, the more they have to lose. If you came out of this thing and all of your connections were gone, you would still have about a year and a half only before to get back to where you were, but yet you've got this massive amount of material that you've written because you're doing nothing but writing jokes. So those of us, I mean, I've been doing comedy about 6 years, so I have more to lose, but I don't have as much to lose as somebody who's been doing comedy for 20 years. Those people have 20 years back to whatever foothold they've gotten. So this is a good time for those of us who are sort of figuring out what our career is going to be, because it really is just forcing us to stop working on becoming a successful comedian and get back to just writing jokes.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. I actually think it's been – I was thinking just the other day that – this is maybe making me a bit of a better comedian. Like, we'll see what happens when we actually get back on stage, whenever the hell that is. But there's definitely been things that I can point to that are positives, you know, sort of ability 100%. To kind of work a premise a little longer and, you know, not bail on a joke too quickly and, you know, react to things in real time and just, you know, various things that I've been working on. And I was like, oh, yeah, I think that's actually going better. Interesting. And then in terms of, you know, relationships, the people that, you know, people professionally that I've worked with, I'm not going to say I'm not in touch with everybody, but I'm in touch with some of them and continuing to work on it, you know, continuing to do shows. Right. So, you know, that all – it's still available to you. That's the thing. Like, I know people who are like, I'm not doing Zoom shows. That's not for me. That's kind of – this podcast kind of goes in waves, and that's sort of at the moment the thing that I'm thinking about because I'm seeing it with people, and I don't really get it. Like I understand if you know because it's definitely weird, but I also feel like this is what we have, so we got to do it. Like it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be great, but you know we got to try.
Yeah, I don't understand how people cannot if you have that need to communicate your ideas to other people, I don't understand the just putting that on hold. I don't quite get it. But maybe other people have. I mean, I think most of the people who are saying things like I'm not going to do Zoom shows are exploring other avenues, podcasting or webcasting or videos or whatever. But to me, that's even less like comedy. That's even less like stand-up comedy. So why would you focus on that instead of focus on something that at least can push you in the right direction so that you'll have some more you'll have something to use at the end of all of this. I really have found that the ability to just sit down, not even the ability, but the requirement to sit down and write jokes all the time has really made me a better comedian. It's made me a more prolific comedian, and it's given me a lot of more material. I mean, I'm personally cannot wait to get on stage with all this new stuff that I have and go back to the places that I've been to. I've been to a lot of venues a couple times, and they know my act. I mean, obviously I have new jokes every time, but the act is the same. You know what I mean? There's the bits that I always do, and the perspective is the same and all of that. I'm really interested in seeing these people and having them see what I'm doing that my life has been my thinking has been shifted a little bit these last couple months. I'm really excited about all that.
I think that's really cool. I would, you know, we got only about a minute and a half left, but I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that I love your voice. That was the first thing I noticed
about you.
Oh, thank
you very much.
And it's amazing. Is that just a Brooklyn thing? Is that that you've got there?
It's a Brooklyn thing. It's not really a Brooklyn thing. I mean, yeah, I'm from Brooklyn, and a lot of Brooklyn comes through in the way. The voice is just the voice. I mean, it's just kind of the way that people – I always go on podcasts, and I feel like people are, like, demanding some sort of explanation. Explain yourself, sir!
No, I was just curious.
No, there's no real explanation. It's just kind of the way that I sound. But, yeah, a lot of people – it's funny to me because you didn't bring it up at first, and I thought, oh, he's not going to talk about it.
Well, I'm sorry to be a basic podcast host. I didn't mean to. I mostly wanted to pay the compliment. And then I figured I'd throw it out there and see if there was any additional information about it. So this has been great, Adam. I really appreciate you coming on. Can you tell everyone where to find you on the social medias?
Yeah, I usually give people my website. It's the easiest way to find me: AdamTellsJokes.com. It's
great
got my
website.
YouTube, my Instagram, my Twitter, everything. And it's got – right now my show list is empty, but it's got – that'll tell you where you can see me and actually hear me say some funny things instead of just talking about myself.
This has been good. This has been good. Adam, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. This has been Brett from the Bunker. We will be back tomorrow at 11 a.m. And please, the most important thing, everybody, stay safe.
Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.